It's go time.
Welcome, everyone, to Quick Kicks here on Third Down Gamble. I'm Don Charbon, and a very special guest, a returning guest, actually, Upton Bell, the son of Bert Bell, former commissioner of the NFL. And I'm so happy to have you back, Upton.
I love Canada. I've spent many years going back and forth there, visited many times. In fact, I will tell you, thanks for having me back. But one of my favorite cities outside of Montreal is Quebec. Now, did I pronounce it properly? Quebec.
They're happy that you love them, so I'm sure they'll be good with that.
Outside of Paris, the best food in North America is in Quebec.
Yes, totally true. All right, let's talk about some business here. One of the things that you are is a historian. Of course, with your connections through your dad through to the NFL and its essentially its growth period, what can you tell me? We've got the UFL, the United Football League, coming online in the next few weeks, starting its inaugural season. The NFL went through a ton of growing pains back in the day, back when teams were falling left, right, and center. Can you tell me a little bit about that era and what it was like, say, from the 20s onward?
Well, actually, even though I wasn't born in the 20s, I can tell you because I did know some of the people growing up that were around during that period. And in 1920, when they founded, the forerunner of the NFL, which became the NFL, was Jim Thorpe in a Canton show up automobile showroom that he and a group of people got together and formed what would be the National Football League. Now, between 1920 and 1935, when Bert Bell saved actually football, and I think most sports in North America, basically almost 30 teams, I think it was, went out of business. Buying in 1933 with Art Rooney, who bought in, became the Pittsburgh Steelers, they bought into a league where hardly any teams made money. And the only teams that really made money, any type of money, were the Bears, the New York Football Giants, maybe the Washington known as Redskins then, and to some degree, the Green Bay Packers. The rest of the teams were starving. And my father saw the problem, which we'll get into a little bit later on, in all these other leagues, including the league that I was in as an owner, the WFL. And what he saw is, and he went to the owners' meetings, which was in Pittsburgh at the time, and he said, "Gentlemen, I'm the weakest of your links. And if we're not all equal, we are going to go out of business," basically. I'm paraphrasing it. And he said, "There are a lot like us, and if we don't find some way to make it more equal, we will have no league." Again, I'm paraphrasing. So by a very narrow vote, they agreed to his proposal, which was the weakest team would draft first, and then in reverse order all the way to the strongest team. If he had not persuaded them to do that, and that's why he's called the father of the modern draft, we would not be talking about it. We might be talking about the Canadian Football League as the dominant league, period, because there's just no way people could survive. And remember, you're in the middle of the Great Depression. He was able to do that. And ironically, the first draft was held in Philadelphia at his father's hotel because nobody could really afford to have a fancy meeting in a fancy hotel. So his father, who had one of the biggest hotels in Philadelphia, gave him the place. They all came in on a Saturday. They had drinks. They set up a blackboard, and therefore they had the first draft, which I think went 10 or 11 rounds. And actually, out of that draft, and that applies to today with computers and IQ tests and all sorts of combines and everything else, looking at these players, out of that draft, with hardly any information except for the Street and Smith books and some friends who were coaches in college, four players are now in the Hall of Fame. And the fifth one was Bear Bryant, who decided not to play pro football and then ended up as one of the great college coaches of all time. So it was the Great American Crapshoot, which today now draws 100,000, 200,000 people who go to the actual site where they're holding it. And yet, if you go back, it was it. And if it is not done, make it. That would be the reason why. No draft, no league.
Why were teams falling by the wayside, other than the fact that there was the Great Depression after the stock market crash of 1929? But what was happening? Were teams just not funded properly? What else was going on?
Nobody went to the games, or not enough people. I mean, you can only fund it so far. And as was repeated years later, in like the World Football League that I was in, people would come in underfunded. I mean, in my father's case, his father was one of the richest. John C. Bell was one of the richest men in Pennsylvania, was the former attorney general, had made a fortune in real estate. And yet his father said to him, his father, John C. Bell, was on the Walter Camp Rules Committee that negotiated with Teddy Roosevelt, actually, to save college football. And eventually, he was the co-founder of the modern-day NCAA. He said to my father, now remember, we got to put ourselves down in those days. He said to my father, not a nickel for pro football. College football is it, the pro game. Who cares about the pro game? My father had to fund it himself, and he barely made it, and basically had to sell the Eagles after he had founded them and went into partnership with Art Rooney. They barely made it in Pittsburgh, especially during the Second World War, and then he eventually became commissioner. But there were so many what-ifs in his life and in the NFL's life. One really false step or enough of them, and we're talking about the plight of the Montreal Canadiens instead of talking about the NFL, which is the most successful league in the world outside of soccer.
It does make one wonder why everything was so tenuous, because if I'm reading what you're saying correctly, college football was where it's at, and you had to basically carve out an audience for the pro game.
You did, until, again, you have to have luck in life, as we all know. But the one thing, the showman, George Halas, when he went from the Dailies and transferred his team into Chicago, he got the bright idea of getting the most famous player in America, the Wheaton Iceman, the Galloping Ghost, Red Grange, signed him to a big contract for those times. His promoter and his representative was a guy called Cash and Carry Pyle. Does that tell you something? And so they signed a lucrative contract and immediately gave the NFL real credibility, because what Halas did is he took them on the road with the Bears and barnstormed all over America. And they were getting crowds like 50,000 people in New York, and it might have been the Polo Grounds or Yankee Stadium, probably the Polo Grounds, and all over the country. What he had done is he had signed Red Grange, who had a built-in name nationally. Everybody knew the Galloping Ghost. In fact, he was so famous that he actually did movies. And you could see him in different movies and different series. He was that popular. So started the league really on its way to becoming what it became later on, the 40s and the 50s.
Your father had to have a lot of courage to say, if I'm the weakest link, then we've got to basically work together to make this an egalitarian sort of approach to the draft. That in the day, I'm sure, would have been met with so much furor, because I'm certain that the power teams wanted to stay as power teams.
Bert Bell, my father, he saw way, way ahead of his time. Great foresight and knowledge, not only of the game, but the business of the game, and really into human beings. He was the great studier of human beings in many ways. When he looked at the NFL, if anybody's seen, I'm sure a lot have, the movie Oppenheimer, and how this guy was so far ahead of his time, J. Robert Oppenheimer. Bert Bell was so far ahead of his time, he really could take what became in Oppenheimer the atomic bomb, and he kind of spread that out throughout the NFL. The other thing that he really had done is real courage. And if I say to anybody in life, no matter what you do, no matter what game or team you follow, what matter what business you have, there are going to be times when things are really bad. That's when you have time in your life to say, you know what, I'm hanging on, but I got to hang on. I've got to have the courage to hang on. Yes, some people go under, because if you're lacking in courage, to me, you ain't going anywhere.
Courage, of course, is a hallmark those early days, because your father is now pushing the idea that we can make it. We have to do these certain things to do so. And you're trying to sell it, not necessarily to the New Yorks and the Chicagos, but to the other teams that are still hanging around, that are still wanting to be a part of this.
The other thing was that he was really, I mean, people talk about Pete Rozelle, who I have great admiration for and was his successor. But basically, my father saw the key to pro football, which is so even more true today, was television. Ironically, when I had the open of my collection at the University of Massachusetts 2 years ago, the son of one of the players who played for my father's team, the first pro football televised game in history. It was in New York. It was actually in Brooklyn. And there was a team in the NFL called the Brooklyn Dodgers, believe it or not. Not the baseball team, the football team. And they were playing, I think the year was 1936, 37, something along that lines. And the World's Fair was being held in New York. And NBC decided they wanted to experiment by televising a football game and then showing it to the different patrons up on a big screen during the World's Fair. And you can go back and look at the whole history of it and how incredible it was, that first experience, and how they actually did the game. My father saw what television could do for the NFL. This is in the middle or late 30s. And as a result, he was the first one, not Monday Night Football on ABC, but Burt Bell was the first one, once he became commissioner, and in the 50s, signed the first national television contract with the Dumont Network, which later on then went to CBS. But that, to me, as much as his decision on the draft, and we haven't mentioned it yet, his decision to force the owners to implement sudden death, which we saw in 1958 with the greatest game allegedly played, that television policy along with the draft, to me, made and cemented the NFL, and they were all his brainchild.
Television is always a huge vehicle for the NFL. But when you bring it in the first case, you have this sort of thought pattern that must be going on. We want the games televised, but we want people in the stands. Blackouts obviously come into existence. How does a commissioner and a league juggle with that?
Well, first and foremost, he, during that time, to make sure what you're talking about, that the audience, the live audience would remain, because if you televised your way in home games, then basically as the league was growing, unlike now, you would be defeating yourself. So he actually, and he fought in Congress, he fought presidents of the United States, he fought everybody, the idea, because he had the blockout. And if your game wasn't sold out within a certain amount of time, then the game was not free on television. And of course, I can remember in 1957, the championship game, Detroit versus Cleveland in Detroit for the championship. The Governor Soapy Williams of Michigan tried to put pressure on my father to the point of he called Nixon, who was the vice president at the time, asked him to come in and put pressure on Burt Bell to lift the blackout. They had dinner the night before. Nixon tried to pressure. My father said, look, there are people that stood out in line for hours in a snowstorm to buy tickets to the championship game. I am not going to screw them. And he talked Nixon right down. I'm telling you, that was one of the great days of my life. And ironically, about 14 years later, when I'm a presenter in Canton, my first year as general manager with the Patriots, I end up talking to Nixon. I know he didn't remember that I was the little guy, Burt Bell's son, sitting there while Burt Bell backed him down. And we had a great conversation about football. Nixon, by the way, for all the things that are said about him, he really knew football and he loved it. We had nice talk in Canton. So what Burt Bell saw was how to use television, but he also had to, unlike today, have to balance it with the idea you can't screw the fans that are going to come out to the game. And if you put everything on free TV, and he fought through the courts, he became a full-time lobbyist in Washington, fought the senators and congressmen down there, that you can't do that, it would ruin the league. So again, that's the courage part of it. You got to stand up to people, and he did.
The biggest thing, I guess, in all of this is there are cautionary tales and there are strength of character moving forward tales.
Well, it's interesting that I'm called probably two or three times a week by people, particularly historians, who want to know 60, 70, 80 years later, who's this Burt Bell? Who was he? How did he do these things? That they're amazed at his stories. I've just, about 6 months now, a year ago, just before the Super Bowl, one of the top writers of the Washington Post called me and he said, you know what? He said, I just happened to be looking back at the history of the NFL through the Super Bowl. And he said, I saw your father's name. And he said, I started to look at the history of this guy. And he said, I was blown away. Who was this genius? And he ended up writing up a terrific story on the little guy that smoked too much, but really changed the history of pro football. As I said, there's stories out there everywhere. You really have to, and especially in those days, if you couldn't look ahead and be able to see what it might be, you'd have thrown the towel in. I would have.
Again, you need somebody that has foresight to carry an entity.
Well, you not only have to do that. Think about, again, it's easy to say today to your listeners, look at this game. Look at the explosion of it. You can't miss. I once told somebody, by the way, Don, I said, name me the last time an NFL team ever sold for a loss. And now it costs you billions of dollars to buy one. And most people, even the billionaires, are balking now because they've got to find the financing. But again, when you look at the time and the period and you say to yourself, my gosh, our backs are against the wall. The league during the Second World War, again, my father came to the rescue because all the players had gone to World War II. And the owner said, we're going to shut the league down. And Burt Bell said to him, if you shut down the NFL, we'll never open again. He talked them out of it. He said, not only that, there's a new league coming in after the war. And he was right about that. The old All-America Conference that had the Cleveland Browns and the 49ers. And he said, you can't shut it down. I think he got it passed by only two votes. And then what he did is he merged the Eagles and the Steelers, and they called themselves the Steagles. And then the next year, the Steagles and the Cardinals, the Pitt Cardinals, had to merge to stay alive. In fact, there was a book that's in another collection I have of all the famous authors I've interviewed. There's a book that was written and a bestseller about Burt Bell's Eagles Steelers and their merger to save the NFL during the war. All of these things that you see today and then you go back and see then. And one of the problems that I have is that we have become a society through our cell phones, our computers, that the only thing that young people growing up are learning is what they know in the last 10 minutes. My growing up and the people around me, we wanted to know the past history, whether it was sports or history itself. It was discussed. You wanted to know who were these people. There's no interest like that anymore. And I think particularly I'd like to address your young audience, or parts of the young audience you have out there, or ones that have children. Have your children, whatever it is, sports or not, go back and learn about history, because if you don't, what's the old saying? It will repeat itself. That's something that I see, that I learned as a kid, no matter what it was, that I wanted to find out about the past. You don't have that anymore, and it's really a shame what people are really missing.
In your life, you also have owned a football team, and that would be the New York Stars, which became the Charlotte Hornets in the World Football League. We've just had an interview with Mark Speck, who is an excellent historian on the World Football League. What was it like? What got you into it in the first place? What precipitated this whole business of being an owner in that league?
I had a death wish. what I saw was the opportunity to get in on the ground floor, thinking back to when my father started, never had the money that he had, but I saw the potential in the league, some of the rules, some of the ideas that were being brought into the game, and also the idea that even though the league had financial problems, particularly that first year, is that the opportunity to have a say and help form something that could be at least, if not a foe of the National Football League, that someday maybe a few of the teams might be taken in by the league, like you had with the All-America Conference and later on with the NFL and the AFL. I saw some of that. Understanding the reality, which is some teams were going broke. So I made a deal with Howard Baldwin and a guy by the name of Bob Smertz, who owned the Celtics at the time and was having his own financial problems in the NBA, to actually take an option on the Stars. And I had for a long time felt that the South in particular, other than Atlanta and New Orleans, the South was underpopulated as far as pro sports teams were concerned, and particularly in the NFL. For years, even when I was with the Colts, I had scouted in and around Charlotte, North Carolina, and saw the possibility of North and South Carolina having a team, and yet close enough to Atlanta. With that said, I went in, I got an option, took them to Charlotte, put together my own ownership, put together eventually a terrific coaching staff, and many players when the league went under that ended up going to the NFL. And every one of my coaches went to the NFL. One of them, Lindy Infante, became the Packers head coach eventually. I saw all of that possibility. I wanted the opportunity to be an owner and see what it was like, even with the responsibility financially of knowing that you could go under. And you know what? It was like the old NFL back in the 20s and 30s. That's what it was, except the difference was that a lot of the guys that came into the league were underfunded. And then they had a national TV contract with TVS. Everything was going well until the public began to find out that these teams were underfunded and some of the things that were said were not true. Gary Davidson, who could sell you anything, Brooklyn Bridge, Manhattan Island, you name it. And he started two other leagues, except for one thing. He was so anxious to get people to buy teams that in the end, he didn't get people that really had the money to do it. And as a result, with all the machinations, in the second year, the league went down. And one of the interesting stories, we had proposed the idea of the league signing to get a television contract the second year, to signing a deal with Joe Namath that he would own a piece of the team, and even to the point of when on the field, when you rushed him, that knowing he had bad knees, that you wouldn't go for his knees, that you know teams would brush by him, whatever else it was. Like everything else, and like the big if Namath had signed it with us and agreed to do it, I think the league would have survived. How long, I don't know. But there are so many other things about it that in some ways have to do with football and other ways don't. John Bassett of Toronto had the great idea of going out and signing Larry Zonka, Paul Warfield, and Jim Kick and stealing them away from the Dolphins. Should have kept the team in Canada, in Toronto. But then he decided to take it to Memphis, and I said, wrong place for big names like that. What happened the second year? He began to lose money, And ironically, one of the most interesting dates of my life is that he got Elvis Presley to not invest in a team, but he was giving a piece of the team in return for publicity. And Elvis Presley came to the game that night, and Bassett took me back and introduced me to him. And I can tell you this, I said to somebody, he'll be dead in 2 years. And that's exactly what happened. It was really fascinating to meet him, see all the people who were surrounding him. He was profusely sweating and hardly said a thing. And I don't think it had anything to do with, well, I'm too important with you. I think you were looking at the end of the king of rock and roll. There are many experiences in the World Football League. There were rules in the league that I liked, and I liked the open style of the game, and I liked the action point. Again, there were some owners in the league, like John Bassett, who were really good, and it could have been a good thing. Dreams go down the drain, and it never made it. Ironically, there is a fan group led by Richie Franklin that still, 40-some years later, still has a website of the Charlotte Hornets. The Charlotte Hornets live in my mind, not my wallet.
Going through that experience, 1974, is that the year that you got the team, or did you get them in 75?
Yes, 1974. We sold out one of the biggest crowds that they had there, and I was able to get Arnold Palmer to invest in the team. And eventually in the second year, and I could probably do a second book on all of the people that I met and the fascinating experiences I had. And even from Charlotte, I got Arnold Palmer, who had the biggest Cadillac agency in Charlotte, to invest in the team. He came to the opening game. People were mobbing him. I mean, it was quite a night. He gave me a gold Cadillac to ride around in, which I did for 2 years. And then when the league went down, people were throwing oranges at it. Also, in the second year, Ted Turner came over, and he had one of his TV stations was in Charlotte, WRET, and he wanted to do our broadcast. And he said, "I'll take you all over the South. Screw that National Football League. We're going to do this. We're going to do that." Really, one of the ironies, which I wrote in my book, President at the Creation, is at the end he was talking about, I'm paraphrasing, he said, "You know, I'm probably going to take a chance," he said, "but I'm looking at founding this new network called Cable News Network." And he said, "I'm not sure it'll really make it." And I stupidly said, "You're probably right." And I put it in a book. But just some of those fascinating conversations with some people that had something to do with football, but many had nothing to do with it.
What happened in the 1974 playoffs? There seems to be almost chaos assigning who was going to play who and what cities were going to be used.
Well, I'll tell you what exactly happened, because we made the playoffs. But the problem was, the way you made the playoffs then is who could afford to travel, who could afford to go to the cities, what cities had a problem. For instance, the Birmingham Americans, they had tax problems. They were going to close them down. I mean, there were all sorts of things. We had something out of a Dodge commercial. We were playing a game in Shreveport, and I didn't know that Bob Smertz, the owner, had owed thousands of dollars to a cleaning service when his team was in New York. So we go down to play the Shreveport Steamers. Just before the game, this sheriff said, "You can't play the game, because we're here to collect the uniforms." I said, "For what?" And he said, "Because they've got an attorney, and the guy in New York said that Smertz owes them like $30,000 or $40,000 for equipment and for cleaning." We were able to talk them into letting us play the game. And then after the game, I told the players, "Get the equipment, let's get it out of here. Get it on the bus so we can get it the plane before these people close in on us." The sheriff was waiting right at the door, so the uniform stayed there basically until it was finally paid off. I had to guarantee that we would pay off Smertz's bill in order to get the uniforms back. bottom line, really, Don, was the teams that could afford to play, not the teams that were finishing first or second or made the playoffs, but the teams in the stadiums that were available. That's how bizarre it really was.
If I'm not mistaken, the Florida Blazers played pretty much the entire season without being paid, and they go all the way to the championship game.
They did, and you know, I was part of that because, again, going back to here, when I first came to the Patriots as their general manager, I made Rami Loud the head of pro scouting and then brought in Buck O'Kilroy to do the college scouting. And then Rami always wanted to own a football team. And unfortunately for him, I think he's still in prison, or he's probably dead now. He wanted to own a team, and he got in trouble with, they never got paid. I'm sitting there due to play in Charlotte. The game is sold out. Bob Davis is the quarterback for the Blazers, and they had another running back who was the MVP of that year, Tommy Riemann. I think a day before the game, I'm sitting in my lawyer's office. We're getting ready to play. The game sold out. And they get a call from Florida, and it's a judge in the court calling from the court and basically saying, Mr. Bell, these gentlemen don't have enough money to come to Charlotte. He said, the only way I'm going to let them out, he said, is if you pay their way, they pay the plane fare, their way to Charlotte, and pay their paychecks. That's the only way I'm going to do it. Now, can you imagine if you got a call like that? So I had to assure the judge that we would pay for the airfare and pay the players. I mean, it wasn't huge contracts like today. But again, it put me in a financial bind, but I had to do it. The game was sold out. Can you imagine going out and announcing before the game to the mob? I'm sorry, no game tonight, but we're going to keep your money? They came up. They played, and actually they beat us. How do you like that for irony? And after the game, I went down the field to talk to Bob Davis, one of the players, and he thanked me for us paying, not the way up, but for paying their paychecks after the game. It was, it was unbelievable. I mean, nobody would believe that today.
By October of 1975, the league has now come to a point where it's got to take a decision if it's going to continue or not. What were those discussions like?
Well, first and foremost, at the end of the season, I thought we had a good chance the second year because a guy by the name of Chris Hemeter, who ended up being kind of the quasi-commissioner of the league, was one of the owners of the Y franchise, proposed something that we called the Hemeter Plan, which because people were you know, spending huge amounts of money the year before and they couldn't afford it. And you saw teams getting in financial trouble, paying big prices to players. I mean, John Bassett was one of the few people that could actually pay for Zonka, Kick, and Warfield. But a lot of the other owners couldn't, and they were signing these players for these huge amounts. So the Hemeter Plan that he helped put in, and we actually lived by it, and actually made some money, was the players would be signed to a percentage of the gate tied to their contract. If, let's say, your best players, maybe you have 50 or 100%, and what you do, you give them 10% of all of the money that comes in from the gate and anything from television. So they're playing on percentage contracts. People today are probably saying, what was that? That's the way it was. But what it did is we ran a very tight organization anyway. And what it did was enable us in a smaller market to survive. The problem is some of the other teams didn't do it. And as a result, what had been a really terrific idea, owners began to say, you know what, I can't afford the payroll. I can't afford this. I can't afford that. I'll never forget the last game that my team played was the Charlotte Hornets versus the Philadelphia Bell at Franklin Field, where my father played his college football, where he dropped dead years earlier, and even got my mother to come to the game. The mayor of Charlotte, John Belk, of Belk Department Stores, one of the richest men in the South, he came up for the game. Our backers and our owners flew up in their own private planes, And the night of the game, it was raining like mad, and there was a strike by the union, the workers at the stadium. So there was nobody in the stadium. It was raining, put down the artificial turf, and all I can remember is the squish, squish, squish of the players when they were running and tackling. And that night was the end of the league. A month later, my mother was dead. It was the end of, as I said in my book, right out of a famous novel, The Old Man and the Sea, I said, no more for me. No more fishing for me. That was the end of my dream of owning a football team. And actually, it was the end of being either a general manager or owner in the NFL or any league.
What is the legacy of the World Football League? You've been on the inside. You know what it was about. Other than a couple of rule changes that have been adopted, the action point kind of a hybrid now used with the two-point conversion. What else came from that era?
Well, to be frank with you, a lot of unpaid bill. People can dream all they want, but the reality is it was a good idea in search of money. And it was a great lesson. And I've seen all the iterations afterwards. The USFL now was a league that really had a chance because they had some money. But again, they failed for many reasons. And you have to understand something. In 1975, when the NFL was on strike, I got a call from NBC and they said, you know what? We'd like to put one of your games on. We know who you are. And it might be a good thing because we're not doing NFL games on strike on. There was some hope, understanding that it's just too hard to compete against the NFL. They've tried NFL Europe, which I think had a great idea. And the NFL closed that down. Why, I don't know. The NFL has become Burt Bell's dream, George Halas's dream, Art Rooney's dream. That dream is a reality now, thanks to those people. But the reality is that they are so strong, the only thing that can defeat them are themselves. You can have every league you want, but the power of television, the power of the money, is just too big for anybody to compete against.
Now, to be fair to the WFL on one level, three of the centers, I believe, now have NFL franchises. Memphis, well, Charlotte, and Jacksonville.
Immediately I called Dan Rooney, who was the head of the, when the league went down, I called Dan Rooney of the Pittsburgh Steelers, who was the head of the expansion committee. I said, Dan, no matter what happens to me, this is a great place for the NFL. I said, you know, I've done all of the work here. I know all of the understanding. I know how it really shapes up. And I was hoping one day that my team would be one of the teams in the NFL. But it wasn't going to work because Jerry Richardson had the money. I didn't have the money to do that. And even then, the World Football League proved that you could have franchises in different places. Now, the one thing that I will tell you right now, in Jacksonville, I would have never put an NFL franchise in Jacksonville. I saw, because we played against them, I saw, okay, they're fine for the WFL. They're lucky it's the NFL where everybody is getting billions of dollars for their TV rights. Because if they didn't, Jacksonville would be just another town. Sorry, Jacksonville, I love you, but that's the reality.
The United Football League is coming up this spring, starting play. From all of this that we've discussed, what's the cautionary tale and what do they need to watch for?
Their money and how much are they going to pay their players? I mean, I can tell you even, luckily the NFL is rolling in money, at least right now. If you have the money, fine, you can burn it all you want. But if you are a new league starting out, you've got to be careful of what you pay your players. And you have to have some type of television contract. The live gate is very important, no question. But television rules football. If you don't have a TV contract and you're paying your players too much money, be just another Moby Dick. Goodbye.
Ouch. Poor white whale.
That's what I could say. Well, you have the Canadian Football League. It survived everything. I used to come up for the Grey Cup, and we drafted a few players from there, and so I know its history. I know it's three downs and all the other stuff. You know, we get it on ESPN here. I actually like it. And you ask yourself, how is Canada and the Canadian Football League survived all these years? That's what I would be looking at if I'm a USFL. And I know they put the new rules in on the kickoff and everything else like that.
The CFL, there's, I think, twofold. One is its provenance. It's had such a long history. And the other thing that it's done well at, especially in recent years, and this goes to your other point, they found owners with deep pockets. They can weather bad times.
Yep. Well, that's good. And I like the idea when I see the crowds at the game. When you have something that is a community, it's a pride of a community, which you have a lot of in Canada. Even with your hockey teams, I mean, some of those outposts. And by the way, I've driven much of Canada through the Canadian Rockies and everything else. I love Canada. I love going there. I love the people. They're very warm. There's so many things that I do like about it. But I do see, even in the years the Canadian Football League was struggling and the fight between the NFL, which my father was in the middle of, and guys jumping to Canada. How about this? Bud Grant was one of the few players, if any, that told my father to go screw himself when he refused to sign a standard player's contract, and he went to Canada. And then, of course, he ended up being one of the great coaches in NFL history with the Vikings. Jim Finks, what was a general manager in Canada. I actually saw Jim Finks play for the Steelers. Great general manager, both of them Hall of Famers. There were a lot of people that went to Canada, Doug Flutie, you name them, got themselves really going there or finished their careers there, whatever. But when you have that regional love of something, I can remember 67, 68, going to the Grey Cup in Montreal. This guy is riding a horse into the hotel lobby. And I said, this is really fabulous. I said, there's nothing like this. This is the Wild West. There are so many things to really like about Canada and their love of particularly of the Canadian Football League. So again, my advice is, if you don't have the money, don't get in the game, and also you've got to figure out where is your audience. And if you don't have an audience, you're not going anywhere.
Upton, you've got a legacy that you've developed. Talk to me about legacy you have built up at as the University of Massachusetts.
There's two collections. One hasn't been announced yet. The University of Massachusetts, if people will go online, take a look at it. It's an amazing history of not only a family, but America going back over 100 years. My grandfather actually played in the stocking cap era in the 1885s at the University of Pennsylvania. Well, his son was the governor, but he ended up becoming the Attorney General of Pennsylvania and then on the Walter Camp Rules Committee. All of his history, and then my father's history from World War I all the way through to all the people that he knew and the things that he brought to the game, to my mother, who was a Ziegfeld Follies star in the 20s and 30s, and actually met my father at a party for Charles Lindbergh. There's all sorts of history there with artifacts, my Super Bowl ring, you name it. And we've even found letters between Abraham Lincoln and my grandmother's father from back in the 1800s. There's so much stuff there that I hope people have a chance to go online, take a look at it. Also, there's another collection that hasn't opened yet, the University of Massachusetts Lowell, that has over 500 authors and their books that I've interviewed over, 45, 50 years, including almost 40 Pulitzer Prize winners and 5 Nobel Prize winners. There's a great history there, and I'm glad I'm still breathing to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Upton. Always a pleasure to talk with you. You're such a fountain of knowledge, and I just love learning about history. It's something that I know you're very, very passionate about, and I appreciate you taking the time. I imagine you must be able to look in the mirror and say, yes, I've had a life well lived.
I've lived it. Listen, it's been terrific, and it can continue to be terrific. I just hope one of the things that I mentioned to you just briefly, I know as we're ending the interview, one of my real concerns for all of pro sports and now college sports is gambling. I'm telling you, I saw as a boy in 1946, my father, his first year as commissioner, being called by the district attorney in New York and saying, Mr. Bell, you better get here a day early because we found out that two players, both played in Canada, by the way, Frank Filchuk and Merrill Hapes, have received bribes to throw the championship game. They didn't report them. My father getting on the train, he was going to go down the next day to New York and meeting with the district attorney all night long, deciding that he would let Filchuk, who was the quarterback for the New York Giants, play in the game. Merrill Hapes, he suspended, and then he suspended both of them for life. They did come back later on. If that night didn't take place, and if he hadn't stepped in and eventually do what he did, which was hire ex-FBI agents through his friend and his former player, Davey O'Brien, and J. Edgar Hoover, the NFL would have been out of business. And I see what's happening today, and I am not somebody with a foot stuck in the past. What I see is once the Supreme Court declared that you could gamble, basically, legitimately, every league jumped into it, every league, NBA, NHL, all of them into it, and they're making millions and millions of dollars. There's always that danger, and it's already happened to a couple of players in the NFL, that somebody's going to get caught up in a gambling scandal. And the minute the public, and my father used to say that, has any doubts about whether a game's on an up and up, you're screwed. And not only that, the other thing that we're seeing more and more of now, particularly here in Massachusetts, are young gambling addicts. Kids now, you have your cell phone? We're doing this interview by cell phone. Kid can go on, and a teenager, and gamble on anything you want. I just hope there's not a scandal, but more importantly, how many in Massachusetts, it's a real problem, how many young gamblers that they have that are in real trouble? That's my real concern for pro sport. And no, all sports, because you can bet what time of day it is now. So I'm just saying, I'm leaving a warning. I hope it doesn't come true, but somewhere along the line, you're going to have a scandal, and then what? And I say to the young people in your audience or to the parents of young people, please have your kids learn about whatever they love, whatever sport, tennis, boxing, or just history, period. Put the phone down, forget TikTok for a few minutes, and get back and learn about your great heroes or the players that you follow. Just find out about them first.
Sounds good. Thanks again, Upton. I really appreciate talking to you.
For listening to our show. Third Down Gamble is hosted on Podbean and can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Follow us on Twitter at Third Down Gamble. Join us again at the Third Down Gamble podcast. Audio worth watching.
Third Down Gamble uses the expert resources provided by Canadian Football League player and game statistics, for analytics, game notes, and statistics, and 3downnation.com for news, insight, and in-depth analysis. Please visit cfl.ca and 3downnation.com for the most up-to-date information on the Canadian Football League.